Menards is the ultimate home improvement destination in the Midwest. Since 1958, we've been supplying you with everything from hardware to automotive needs. We believe in helping you save big money on every project, big or small. From top-of-the-line tools to plumbing supplies, paint, and appliances, we've got you covered. We thank you for making Menards a part of your year. From our family to yours, have a safe and happy new year. Save big money
at Menards. Welcome back to That's Politics, and today we're going to be looking at the different mainstream ideologies, conservatism and liberalism, and analyzing things that I do like and don't like about each. This episode was requested by Maria. She left a Facebook comment on one of my posts. So if you want me to cover a specific topic in an episode, you can always drop a request on the official podcast Facebook page or by emailing me at MackenzieAtkinson@thatspoliticspodcast.com. You can also find it on the website linked, I think, at the bottom. I need to check that, but I think that's where that's at. So let me introduce you more to this topic before we deep dive a little bit more. I want to focus on the ideologies rather than the political parties themselves for two main reasons. One, ideologies do not always line up with the parties. You can be a Republican with some liberal ideology and vice versa. Not everyone's a Democrat or a Republican because there is more to politics than party affiliation. I know I did an episode with Chris Cooper about political affiliation, and he even brought up that a guy changed his party affiliation 30 times in the same year. So obviously there's more to politics than if you align with Democratic or Republican. I want to also mention that there has been a dramatic increase of people who are unaffiliated with either party, because they just don't like the connotation that comes with being labeled a Republican or a Democrat. The second reason is that parties adapt their voter base to get as many people on their side as possible. I mean, think about how many different political parties there are, but when you look at what they stand for, many of those same beliefs have already been absorbed into the two mainstream political parties. For example, the Green Party. They are very much environment-based in their policies, but all those policies have already been adopted by the Democratic Party, which means that that voter base that might affiliate with the Green Party chooses to vote for or align more with the Democratic Party instead. This might be kind of based off of not wanting to quote-unquote waste your vote, but that is a can of worms for a whole nother episode. Now, this might seem a little contradictory based on what I've said previously about how each party isn't trying to get that moderate voter, but I'm looking at this as capturing the most extreme voters on either end, which has kind of pulled the parties away from each other, if you get what I mean. So those are my main two reasons as to why I'm only focusing on the ideologies and not the political party themselves. Now, I want to define what a conservative is and what a liberal is. Now, actually finding something that puts a solid definition on conservatism and liberalism is kind of difficult because it can mean so many different things to each person. So for those of us that were in high school from 2015 on, you guys might know about Khan Academy, K-H-A-N Academy. I hated it growing up, but they have this definition that they used for their study guides. They say that conservative ideology tends to believe that the government should be small and mainly operating at state or local level. They favor minimal government interference in the economy, and they prefer private sector-based solutions to problems. Social conservatives, they define that separately. They believe that the government should uphold traditional morality and therefore should impose restrictions on contraception, abortion, same-sex marriage. These people fall on the right side of the aisle, which obviously if you're listening to this podcast, you know the difference between right and left of the aisle. But I just wanted to clarify. They then go on to define liberal ideology as wanting government interference in the economy and to provide a broad range of social services to ensure well-being and equality across society. They usually also believe that the government should not regulate private behaviors. You could talk about sexuality and abortion. And they do fall on the left side. Again, you guys know this. I personally lean towards the liberal side of the political spectrum, And you also probably already know that if you've listened to any of my other episodes. So I'll be looking at what I like about conservatism. And through that analysis, you can see where I don't agree with liberal ideology. This is also to show that not everyone agrees with everything that their ideology stands for. Nothing is ever completely absolute, and there's always going to be room for criticism. Now, I will pick out things that I agree with conservatives about, and I will explain their overarching goal, and then I'll insert my perspective and interpretation of the policy stance. Now, remember, politics is trying to achieve the same goal, but having different ways of going about it. That is the main understanding of politics. The idea is that we want to see our country prosper and achieve great things. We just have different ways of thinking about it. Protecting women, for example, the overarching belief and the goal is to protect women. Liberals go about saying that we should expand reproductive rights to protect women. Conservatives say that we should keep transgender women out of the bathrooms to prevent quote-unquote creeps from getting in the bathroom, although there is nothing to back up that claim. But neither here nor there. If you want to listen to my transgender bathroom debate episodes, you guys can go back there and debate in the comments. But let's get into some policy stances for conservatives. While researching this and diving into my web rabbit holes, I came across House Speaker Mike Johnson's official page where he details the 7 core principles of conservatism. I'm going to go through all 7 of those, read the paragraph that he has on the website, and I'll have it linked in the show notes and the blog post so you can follow along. So let's start off with 1, individual freedom. It says, quote, "The birth of our great nation was inspired by the bold declaration that our individual, God-given liberties should be preserved against government intrusion. That same conviction informs our conservative policy decisions still today. In America, we proclaim the self-evident truths that all of us are created equally and granted by God the same inherent freedoms, such as the natural and unalienable rights of life, liberty, conscience, free speech, and the free exercise of religion, and the ability to pursue happiness, own property, build wealth, and defend ourselves and our families. The purpose of government is to secure these rights, and the ideas we advance should always aim to maintain and increase the liberty of the American people." Unquote. And this is so right. Everyone deserves rights. That is foundational. That was just part of the way we were raised, that everyone has these rights. The problem I see here is that, yes, everyone has these rights, but it always seems that when another group, say a minority group, gets the same rights that the majority has always had access to, they see it as, oh, they're taking our rights away. That's not the case. Just because someone gets the same rights that you've always had access to doesn't mean you lose your rights. It is enforcing that everyone has these rights. You have to be able to understand and acknowledge that minority groups are purposefully disadvantaged to maintain majority white control. Unfortunately, that is the truth. That is the way that our country was built. So when we get the civil rights movement, when we have the 4 waves of feminism, it's just expressing the need for us to all be treated equally and have the same rights. Moving on to 2, limited government, it says, quote, "For individual liberty to be championed, government must be reduced. We believe, as our founders did, that legitimate government operates only by the consent of the governed and is more efficient and less corrupt when it is limited in its size and scope. When applied as written, our incomparable Constitution provides important safeguards against government encroaching a vital separation of powers and a necessary system of checks and balances. Federalism, decentralized authority, and the elimination of unnecessary regulations and bureaucracy help ensure that government serves the people, and not the other way around. The best protection against government largesse is an engaged and informed electorate." Unquote. Now, checks and balances, along with federalism, are foundational for our country. Again, we know this. Unfortunately, when you want to look at the governing the government, right? The parties have guided our voter-based beliefs rather than it being the other way around. So thus, they are grooming the governed to believe what they want. It's very manipulative, and that is the situation that we see ourselves in. So yes, the idea of the governed telling the government, hey, this is how we want it done. Great idea. But it's not the reality that we live in. Also, I would like to add, regulation is good. When unchecked people and businesses continue to go about their ways, they will exploit the ever-living hell out of people that work for them or their consumers. Think about what goes into your food. I remember being in, high school, like freshman year, talking about the industrial boom in the United States and how, when unchecked, these big corporations were exploiting child labor and paying these kids cents to the dollar and pretty much working in sweatshops. Children ended up dying. So the regulation saying that you can't exploit children, you can't force them to work these long hours, there's a purpose for them. What's that one State Farm ad? It's, we know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two. That's where regulation comes in. Now, power being returned to the states is a great idea. Reducing government size, you know, interference with our lives, great idea. But you have to look at each state as their own little country. They have their own individual economies, and some of them could be compared to some third world countries. They can't afford to provide all the programs that the federal government provides on a whim. I know the Big Beautiful Bill, which I'm still working on it, guys. Still working on my breakdown. Part of their reform in the Big Beautiful Bill is making the states pay more of their share, quote unquote share, for SNAP benefits, meaning that they're taking on, I think it's like 75% of the payload of it now. And some of these states are not going to be able to afford that, which means that entire states are no longer going to have SNAP benefits. So yes, idea of reducing the power of the federal government and returning it to the states, great idea. But do we understand as a country what that means to put the burden onto a different entity? The burden is still there. Just because you're reducing the size of the federal government doesn't mean that burden just disappears. It gets pushed down the line, which means it gets pushed farther and farther onto the taxpayers. Okay, now moving on to number three. This is the rule of law principle. It says, quote, ours is, quote, a government of laws and not of men, unquote. And the rule of law is our foundation. To maintain ordered liberty in a civilized society, public and private virtue should be encouraged, and justice must be administered equally and impartially to all. Each branch of the government must adhere to the Constitution, and the judicial branch must not be allowed to assume or exercise legislative or executive powers. Transparency and accountability are keys to good government, and Congress must faithfully perform its constitutional responsibilities of oversight. Unquote. Okay, there's a lot to unpack in that one. Let's start with the first section of it, talking about justice must be administered equally and impartially to all. Everyone should follow the law. That is pretty standard. And they should be subject to the appropriate punishments. And that includes large companies, billionaires, lawmakers, and law enforcement. Okay? People and businesses should not be allowed to hide behind money, status, or occupation to avoid accountability. You want to talk about applying law? You want to talk about applying rule of law to all? Release those Epstein files. Right? That, I think this is the biggest example of how we want people in power to also be held accountable for crimes that they commit. So just release the Epstein files. I know things might change by the time that this episode airs on Monday. We have not made any headway in releasing those files. I know Trump has given the order for some of the files to be released as is pertinent, I guess is what he would describe it. But my dad always likes to say that we need a clean house in the government and get rid of career politicians. But the best way to do that is to release the files, because then we know a lot of them are on there and they would serve prison time for their crimes if we just release the files. Now let's look at the next part of this rule of law section, that each branch of government must adhere to the Constitution and the judicial branch must not be allowed to assume or exercise legislative executive powers. There is a conservative belief that the judicial branch has been weaponized against the Trump administration. I need to take you guys back to high school when we talked about judicial review. I know I took like AP poli sci classes, but I'm talking before my junior year of high school. We're talking, I think that also was my freshman year. But we all learned about the idea of judicial review. It is the idea that the courts have the power to examine actions by the legislative and executive branches when those actions end up in the court system. This was established by Marbury versus Madison, you know, back in the day, back in 1803. So by thinking that the judicial branch is overstepping its bounds might be a little contradictory to our foundations as a country, but again, this is me trying to agree with conservative beliefs. I get the idea. You don't want an advocate judge, but we also have to understand laws and how not everything is set in stone. Things can change. I mean, Roe v. Wade, for example, it was a precedent for like 50 years and then got overturned. Again, not everything is set in stone. Now let's move on to number 4, peace through strength. This section says, quote, "The first obligation of the federal government is to provide for the quote-unquote common defense of the United States by securing our borders and protecting our homeland and our strategic interests abroad. We are not, quote-unquote, the world's police force, but because America serves in a natural role of moral leadership in an increasingly dangerous world and weakness invites aggression, we must remain the strongest military power on earth, fully prepared and capable of defeating any adversaries, tyrants, or terrorists under any circumstances, at any time. This requires maintaining sufficient investments in our air, land, sea, nuclear, and cyber capabilities to deter foreign aggression and properly training, equipping, and supporting our troops and their families, as well as our veterans and wounded warriors." Unquote. Yes, we must remain strong and united. But we also need to demonstrate the strength of restraint. Not everything needs to be a gunfight or a targeted bombing mission. We should foster peace where we are able to. Now let's look at it through a fiscal lens, which is pillar number 5, fiscal responsibility. We'll get there in a second. But let's look at it through a fiscal lens. We don't want to spend trillions of dollars on wars, do we? But peace does not make the military-industrial complex any money. So there's this constant lobby for war and war development. So like developing new fighter jets and building up new destroyers and battleships, that's constantly going to be happening. But let's not get into more senseless wars. I think that's one thing that both liberals and conservatives can agree on, is that we don't want to be fighting any more wars. I mean, we just fought a 20-year senseless war in the Middle East. We're not trying to get back into it. When we bombed Iran like a month ago, I think we were all like, whoa, 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 time out. Let's not do this again. We saw what happened, saw it didn't work. We don't want to do it again. But I understand the need for military defense and maintaining a strong composure on an international stage. As a matter of fact, I took an international security class as Russia was invading Ukraine. So it was a great class to take and unfortunately perfect timing. So again, international security is a crazy thing to unpack. We'll get into that in a different episode, but I understand the need for it. Now let's move on to pillar number 5, fiscal responsibility. This is going to be a big chunk. There's a lot in here. Okay. So number 5, this says, quote, "Because government has refused to live within its means, America is facing an unprecedented debt and spending crisis. Federal debt now exceeds $33.5 trillion, and our current fiscal path is unsustainable and dangerous, jeopardizing our nation's economic growth, stability, and security of future generations. Congress has a moral and constitutional duty to resolve the crisis, bring spending under control, balance the federal budget, reform and modernize entitlement programs, eliminate fraud, waste, and abuse, pursue continued pro-growth tax reforms, and permanent tax reductions, and restore regular order and accountability in the budget and appropriations process, unquote. That was a lot, like, listed out as a responsibility of Congress, as a moral and constitutional duty. So let's start looking at it. Yeah, we do need to cut back on spending. We spend a lot without having the funds to do so. Think of it as you have a set amount of bills that you need to pay every month, right? Because you're like, oh, I have this subscription, I have this phone bill, I have an electric bill, I have rent or a mortgage. Think of it as you have all of these things that you have to spend money on because you've already made the commitment. But then you quit your job or you decide to cut down to part-time instead of full-time. You still have to fund all of that, but you no longer have those funds. That is the situation the U.S. has found itself in. We have all of these dedicated spending, right, that we have to spend money on these things, but then we decide to cut back on taxes. Again, I don't like seeing half my paycheck taken out in taxes, but when you understand that there's all these programs that the government has to foot the bill for because they've already said they were going to foot the bill, it kind of like, it's part of the societal social contract, I guess. So we still need to spend X amount of dollars, but we don't have the funds to do it, which puts us in deficit, so on and so forth, and we keep borrowing money. That is like my version of a crash course to economics in the U.S., but again, I'm not an economist, okay, guys? But the conservative solution to dealing with our excessive spending is to cut welfare programs, and this Mike Johnson article calls it entitlement programs. But we as a country, as a society, have been dependent on these quote-unquote entitlement programs since like the Great Depression, which most of us were not alive for. Unless you were born in like the 1920s or the 1910s, you were not conscious enough for the Great Depression, okay? My grandparents weren't alive for the Great Depression. So we don't understand what our lives would look like without these welfare programs, such as Social Security. We don't understand what that world looks like. So my solution is to revamp the Department of Government Efficiency. I think it had good intentions. DOGE had good intentions. They just were targeting rather than looking at the larger picture. They went after these welfare and entitlement programs, looking for fraud, abuse, and waste. But we need to look at the entire government. And I think the best place to start is the place that we spend half of our money at. It's our defense spending. If you look at a breakdown of our like pot of taxes, like half the pie is going towards defense spending. Now I get it. We just talked about the need for having our defense budget being really high and our need to be defense ready, right? But I remember talking with my dad, who served 21 years in the Marine Corps. He did, I think, 3 tours in Iraq. He was part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. But he would tell me that they would throw billions of dollars into defense equipment, and it just sat in storage. It was never used. Billions with a B. Now, the war in the Middle East, that was 20 years. That's probably trillions of dollars that was wasted in the Middle East. And I think that the best way to start cutting back on wasteful spending is to analyze how their budgets are being utilized and make sure that every dollar amount is accounted for instead of just writing the military a blank check for whatever they want. Should they have a lot of money allocated towards them? Yes. Defense technology is very expensive. But we need to keep track of all of the dollar amounts and all of the equipment that we're using and make sure that everything's being used to its fullest potential. Now let's move on to pillar number 6, free markets. It says, quote, government often stands as the greatest obstacle to the progress and prosperity of free people. Free markets and free trade agreements allow for innovation, improvement, and economic expansion as risk takers, entrepreneurs, and business owners are given the liberty to pursue the American dream and create more jobs and upward mobility for more people. We believe competition should be encouraged, and government intervention and regulation should be limited. The people are better qualified to make decisions about their own lives and finances than bureaucrats, and the private sector will outperform the public sector in virtually every scenario. The free enterprise system rewards hard work, and self-sacrifice, and is the basis and genius of the American economy. Unquote. These can be good things if we can regulate them. Think of how humans act. We're very selfish, and we will exploit anything to make a buck. I mean, people, the environment, etc. And yes, if you leave people together, they come together, they create these great ideas. They find new things, they research, they do all these amazing things that they can do. Now let's look at pillar number 7, human dignity. It says, quote, "Because all men are created equal and in the image of God, every human life has an inestimable dignity and value, and every person should be measured only by the content of their character. A just government protects life, honors marriage and family as the primary institutions of a healthy society, and embraces the vital cultural influences of religion and morality. Public policy should always encourage education and emphasize the virtue of hard work and as a pathway out of poverty, while public assistance programs should be reserved only for those who are truly in need. In America, everyone who plays by the rules should get a fair shot. By preserving these ideals, we will maintain the goodness of America that has been the secret to our greatness." Unquote. There's also a lot to unpack here. So let's start off with looking at the first half of it, talking about a just government protecting life, honors marriage, da-da-da-da-da. I have a weird feeling towards this. This is very much talking about implementing moral values through law. And yes, all of us kind of agree on a good set of morals. Like, we know not to kill each other. We know not to steal. We know these things, right? But the idea that it honors marriage and family as a primary institution of a healthy society and embraces vital cultural influences of religion and morality. The religion part is my biggest pet peeve here. Which religion influence are you talking about? I'm assuming it's only Christian in this little segment here. But like, no. No, we shouldn't be using Christian beliefs and Christian morality as an indicator for a healthy society. And the protecting life part, I get into it later in this episode, but trust, it's there. The second half of it, public policy should always encourage education and emphasize the virtue of hard work. I can agree with this. Education is very important. If there's one thing that I hope you get from every single one of my episodes, is that education is key to developing as a society. But I think this section also kind of hints at DEI and the idea of a meritocracy. And again, I have a 4-part series on DEI that everyone should go listen to. But playing by the rules and everyone gets a fair shot, not in this society. That's not the case. There are groups of people who are literally systemically disadvantaged on purpose and have been for centuries. So, great idea. Yes, everyone should have a pathway for success and so that they don't fall under the poverty line. You gotta acknowledge that there are some disadvantages, though. That's my only qualm with this, but I get it. So that's the end of the 7 sections, or the 7 core principles of conservatism. Now let's get into policy specifics that I haven't touched on yet. So the protecting life. See, guys, I'm here. I'm at the protecting life section. I told you guys I would do this. Now, this is pretty much my summary of the abortion debate, okay? Conservatives say that all life is precious, and I agree. Both the unborn child and the mother's lives are valued. Unfortunately, we do not live in a society where that unborn child will prosper once they are born. Let's take a look at the demographics of women who seek abortions. According to the Pew Research Center, they did a study on what is the abortion rate among women in the U.S. and has it changed over time. According to the study, in 2020, there were about 14.4 abortions in the U.S. per 1,000 women ages 15 to 44. And according to the study, the data shows that abortions among women have been declining since 1981. Where previously, in 1981, there were 29.3 abortions per 1,000 women in that same age range. And the CDC's figures also suggest that there is a general decline in abortion rate from the 80s. Now, specifically looking at demographics of women who had abortions, 57% were in their 20s, and about 31% were in their 30s. Teens aged 13 to 19 accounted for about 8% of the people who had abortions, while women ages 40 to 44 accounted for about 4%. And the vast majority of women who had abortions in 2021 were unmarried. That accounted for about 87% of the respondents for the survey. The Pew Research study also says that 42% of all women who had abortions in 2021 were non-Hispanic, while 30 were non-Hispanic white, 22 were Hispanic, and 6 were of other races. For 57% of U.S. women who had induced abortions in 2021, it was their first time they had ever had one. And nearly 4 in 10 women who had abortions in 2021 had no previous live births at the same time that they had had the abortion. So again, these are unmarried young women who are seeking out these abortions. Of course, the conservative belief is that, oh, you can just put the child up for adoption. They end up in our foster care system. So let's take a look at our foster care system and how problematic that is. Okay. Children would literally spend their entire lives in the foster care system and not have the support they need from a community. And children in foster care systems receive welfare program assistance. And if you cut that, they aren't even supported by that. So these kids are just, I guess, left hanging. Let's take a step back and look at before the child would even end up in a foster care system. For this, I highly recommend that everyone go watch the Netflix docuseries called The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez. It is heartbreaking and it made me sick to my stomach. But children like Gabriel needed to be put in a foster care system. But the Child Protective Services, you know, the people literally charged to dedicate their life to protect children, you know, because we got to protect life, did not protect Gabriel in this situation. So these children that are unwanted end up in situations that are dangerous for them, and they most of the time end up dead, injured, just genuinely abandoned. And that ends up hurting them in the long run. And children and their families will need some sort of government assistance because they cannot support themselves on whatever job they have. Hell, I can barely support myself right now working a full-time job, and it's just me. I couldn't imagine trying to feed a family too. And it does take a village to support and raise kids. And that means that we need to spend money on protecting and saving these kids. Think of the U.S. as one big village. We support each other and we want to see everyone succeed. We don't want kids going hungry at school, so I'm completely okay with my taxpayer dollars going towards funding free lunches for schools across the country. It doesn't have to be in my backyard. It doesn't have to be the school district that I live in. I'd be okay funding a lunch for a kid that, like, lives in New Jersey or lives in Florida, California. I'd be okay with that. Because it takes a village, and I'm okay being a part of that village. Now, an extreme, or what I would consider extreme liberal argument, is that women should be able to choose no matter the circumstances. I do agree that abortion shouldn't be a form of birth control. But most situations, that's not the case. This is something that Republicans like to argue. Again, difference between Republicans and conservatives. You could be conservative without being a Republican. But this is something that Republicans like to argue as their reasoning for protecting life, claiming that late-term abortions are the main type of abortion that some doctors will even perform in a quote-unquote abortion once the child is outside the womb, which is completely false. This is just fear-mongering. But a conversation about abortion should be between a woman and her physician. Even if it's a late-term abortion, think about the circumstances that that woman, sometimes that couple, that family could be facing. They've already painted and prepared the nursery, and they're ready to welcome this child into the world. And there's some medical diagnosis that they have to choose between continuing the mother's life or the unborn child's. Like, these are very deep and intimate conversations that I do not think that our federal government should have a say-so in. A phrase that I found back in 2022 when SCOTUS overturned Roe v. Wade was, if I wanted a senator in my uterus, I would have slept with one. But use more colorful language in that phrase. Our elected officials don't even know our names, and they shouldn't be dictating what goes on in our bodies, if that's the case. But again, we need to protect life. And I wish that we were in a society where every child could be born and have amazing opportunities and live their life to the fullest. But that is not the society we live in today. I'm going to transition into another policy. This is the Second Amendment section, okay? So, I am a gun owner. Crazy, I know. But think about it this way. I'm a young woman who lives on her own, and I cannot trust everyone I come in contact with, so I carry for my own protection. That does not mean that I think everyone should have a gun. And I'll stand and die on this hill. Everyone who legally owns a gun knows someone that shouldn't have one. But I do not think that banning all firearms is the answer. I believe education is the key to solving this gun debate. People need to be educated on how they handle a weapon. They need to be properly educated on how they should protect themselves, their families, and their homes. They need to be educated and know when it is an appropriate time to use a firearm and deadly force, but also understand what it means to take a life and how that might impact you and the potential assailant. I was raised my whole life around guns, and there were rules that I had to follow, like treating every weapon as if it were loaded, and I understand that they were not toys. Being educated on something means that we won't be scared of it. And education means that more people will be comfortable handling them. I do believe that there should be deep background checks. And I'll say it again, if you're worried about having a background check ran on you, then you probably shouldn't have a gun. Law-abiding citizens are not worried about following the law. Like, have you broken any laws? No. Have you been involuntarily institutionalized? No. Then those laws don't pertain to you. You have nothing to worry about. You just go through the normal processes of purchasing a firearm, and you're good. I also understand laws limiting gun customizations. Most customizations, like bump stocks, which, again, my family had a tiff over, are based on wants and not needs. I carry a gun because I need protection. But those that want things like bump stocks are adrenaline junkies. They just want to recreate what they see on Demolition Ranch. It's not needed. It's a want. A gun is just as dangerous when it comes stock as it is when it's customized. The fancy customizations are just for fun. And things that are literally built to take lives shouldn't be something that is just for fun and giggles. You go to a range to train yourself. You don't just go to empty a magazine in 30 seconds for fun because that ammo is expensive. So again, I'm all for people having guns. You need to be educated, and you need to be able to understand the weight that you carry when you carry a gun. And when it comes to like gun-free zones and like businesses who don't allow guns in, just respect the business's decision. Them not allowing weapons in their establishment is their choice. It's not an infringement of your rights. You can still have your gun. You just can't carry it in there. Just respect the signage. All right, now I'm going to switch over to immigration. So, of course, we hear so much about immigration, and the biggest thing is illegal immigration. Now, illegal crossings can be dangerous. Drug smuggling from both sides, human trafficking from both sides, those are both dangerous things. But a majority of immigrants are seeking asylum in the U.S. because it is dangerous where they come from. They're given options to either join the crime cartels or join terrorists or die. Those are their options. So they are choosing a better life for themselves and their family by leaving. It's dangerous. They don't like the way their country is running, so they are leaving. For everyone says, if you don't like what's going on in the U.S., you should just leave. This is the same situation these immigrants are facing. They don't like it. They left. Now, I just saw an article from Fox News that citizenship and immigration officials are screening for quote-unquote anti-American sentiment before letting people in. They define anti-American sentiment as anything to do with terrorism, anti-Semitism, or quote-unquote world communism, according to the Immigration and Nationality Act. That's where they reference their interpretation of anti-American sentiment, or anti-Americanism, as they referenced it in the article. But I do question what they define what Americanism is. Like, cheeseburgers, beach vacations? Like, where are we going with this? Like, is it your seven core principles that are Americanism? I'm just confused. Because technically speaking, some things that I say may be defined as anti-American because it goes against what we deem the status quo and what we accept. Could criticism be considered anti-American? I'm not sure. This is just what I saw on Fox News, and I'm questioning it. Now, that was a lot to pack in. Let's wrap this episode up by talking about policy overlap, or what I would think is belief overlap. There is a lot of overlap in goals between liberal and conservatives. They just have different ways of going about it. That is the nature of politics. One and the same thing, just different avenues of accomplishing it. All of us do not like government interference in our day-to-day life. That's how I ended up getting my dad to understand pro-choice stances. We don't want the government telling us what we can and can't do with our own bodies, just like you do. We all want rights to express ourselves, but there is a barrier between liberal and conservative sides. I'll reiterate that just because one group gains a right that you have always had access to, it does not mean that you lose that right. I really want to emphasize this today because of the Supreme Court being asked to overturn Obergefell v. Hodges, which legalized same-sex marriage back in 2015. Heterosexual couples have always had the right to marry, and in 2015, that same right was extended to same-sex couples. Everyone has a right to love who they want, and that right should be respected no matter if you agree with it or not. Everyone has that right. And just remember that we are all people living for the first time, and we have to acknowledge that even if we disagree, we have the same motives. Of course, there are some extremists, and I believe the political parties have become extremists, who champion the idea of my way or the highway. And as a voter base, we have to reject this belief and come back to the table. Be people again. Be a community again. Understand that we have the same goals, and we just have different ways of going about it. Thank you for tuning into today's episode of That's Politics. To view source material for this episode, check out the blog post on the official website at thatspoliticspodcast.com. To recommend a topic for an episode, you can always DM us on the official podcast Facebook page or email me at MackenzieAtkinson@thatspoliticspodcast.com. Come back next time where I will be introducing a new segment called Talking Politics. I am still working on the Big Beautiful Bill breakdown. I sort of bit off more than I can chew there. But anyway, that's all I have for you today. I'm your host, Mackenzie Atkinson, and I'll see you next time.